del Consejo Nacional de Investigación de Canadá. Es un, pues yo diría que tal vez uno de los líderes más sensibles de todo el tema del e-learning a nivel mundial. Su página web y la información que está produciendo todo el tiempo son un punto de referencia importantísimo para quienes estamos trabajando en estos temas. Y pues, yo creo que es no importante por el cargo, el logro, sino porque es un nodo muy importante en nuestra comunidad. Es un nodo que concentra un montón de información y que la redistribuye a muchos lugares. Y en esa medida, pues, está muy enterado de lo que está ocurriendo. Stephen va a estar acompañado todo el día por un traductor, de manera que cuando en el momento de interactuar entre nosotros, si alguno quiere conversar con Stephen y quiere aprender alguna cosa con él, por favor, siéntanse en libertad de hacerlo. Siéntanse en libertad de pedirnos apoyo a cualquiera del equipo de organización que estamos aquí para apoyarnos, para facilitarle el evento. Muchas gracias de nuevo y les pido que recibamos a Stephen con un aplauso.
Thank you. positive developments that have been happening. happened in those 10 years. We gained a whole new type of software called the Learning Management System. And today there are open source learning management systems that are available free of charge for educational institutions to use. Programs like Moodle and Sakai and Boddington and A-Tutor. We've developed community tools and learning design tools, such as LAMS, which is an open source learning management design tool. Connections, which is a type of social software that's used to create and author courses online. ELGG, Drupal, these are community software applications. And of course, WordPress is an application many people use to create their own blogs. And we've seen the growth of supporting software. Applications such as Firefox, which is the web browser that everybody should be using. I don't know if you are using it on most computers, but you should be using it. You are excellent. See, I told you they were very well prepared for this conference. Thunderbird, which is an open source email application. OpenOffice, Audacity. These are some of the tools that we'll be talking about today. And they've been developed only in the last 3 years. We've also seen in that time a tremendous growth in the availability of materials that are available online. Many of you will have heard of MIT's Open Courseware Project. You may also have heard of the Open University's Open Courses, which are fully packaged courses that are available for free use online. There are a number of open educational resources, OER initiatives, being sponsored by bodies like UNESCO and OECD, and of course Creative Commons, and we'll be talking more about Creative Commons today, and ways of sharing Creative Commons materials. And I would be remiss, it is not on the slide, but I would be remiss if I did not mention the One Laptop Per Child project, the OLTC. And I say that because I've seen one here. Do you want to hold that up? So we have, it really exists, and it began as the $100 laptop project, and I guess it's a bit more than that now, but nonetheless, it's a revolution in educational technology and well worth examining, and I hope people will take the time to take a look at that one, as I certainly will. It's interesting, Diego said, everybody's a learner, and not to think of me as an expert. This will be my first time seeing one of those computers, so I will definitely be learning today. We've seen new environments, an explosion of multimedia. Look at all the video cameras and that around here. We've seen podcasts, which are audio recordings, video casts, YouTube, and all of these things for recording multimedia and putting it online. Mobile computing, your telephones, your mobile phones, and personal digital assistants. And we're just beginning to see the beginnings of the three-dimensional web with applications such as Second Life, and we will probably see more of this over time. Don't point this at the audience. That'd be neat if I pointed it and everybody stood up and I clicked it again and everybody. So, we've done work with. The one-to-one computing projects. And this is one of the reasons why everybody here has their own computer. We've learned, and it's been a hard lesson to learn, I think, for many educational institutions, that online learning, e-learning, works best when everybody has their own computer, when everybody is able to work with the computer themselves. And so that's the reason why Diego made sure that there were many computers available so that everybody here would have the chance to practice. The One Laptop Per Child has now launched also in Colombia, and wireless access, and of course we have the wireless network here. So that's the scene, that's the broad scene setting where we sort of are at in the field of educational technology. And our experience with these tools and these technologies has led to the development of an approach to learning calls sometimes the connectivist approach. This is a term that was created by George Siemens, and it's an approach that has been adopted by educators in Canada, the United States, Australia, Britain, Europe, and elsewhere. The main idea of connectivism is found in the computational science of connectionism. And the distinction between connectionism and traditional approaches to learning can be seen in that diagram there. The traditional approach is the man on the left. He's all organized. He's all structured. Every piece fits in its place. And there's a very logical construction. But the type of learning that we find seems to be the way people learn on the internet is more like the man on the right. It's scribbled. It's unorganized. It looks like a man, but it's sort of only accidental that it looks like a man. It could be anything. It's loose. It's free form. It's not structured. And that's why we see conferences like this, which are not your typical conference with one speaker, then another speaker, then another speaker, then another speaker, but rather something that looks on the surface to be unorganized. But what it is really is not managed. What it is all of the people with the tools in their hands who are taking control of their own learning. And so we've seen the development of a concept called the unconference, and in e-learning technology, things like boot camps and bar camps, and here is one of the very first edu camps in the world. The old way of learning is very neat. All the subjects go in their boxes, and you study mathematics for 1 hour, and then you study science for 1 hour. The new way, everything is all mixed in together. It's based not so much on subjects, but using all those subjects as the need comes up to do the sorts of things that you want to do online. It depends a great deal, to a large extent, on user-generated content. And what I mean by that is, instead of the authors and the publishers creating content that they will then deliver to you, people themselves create their own content. They create their own learning materials. And that's why we see the chart on the wall, the online, the wiki spaces, the chance for people who are here who are learning to create their own educational content as part of the learning process. And, you know, just as an aside, this is an approach to learning that has a long history. John Stuart Mill, who's a famous philosopher, writes in his biography about his father teaching him to learn by having him teach his younger brothers. And John Stuart Mill said, I gained a lot out of that. My brothers, not so much. But me, I gained a great deal by being the one to teach. And that's the educational theory here. You learn by teaching. Every time I give one of these talks, I learn. I learn more giving one of these talks than you do. Which is kind of ironic. And it's the idea of learning as flow. The idea of knowledge as flow. We have this picture sometimes in our mind, this knowledge as something that is static, that's stored in books. And you put the books on the library, and it stays there, ready for you to use. And later on, you come down, and it's all been prepared ahead of time. But knowledge and learning don't work like that, especially when we're online. Knowledge and learning become more like a flow, more like electricity in the wall, or more like water in the taps, where it's new electricity, new water every time you go to use it. It's something that doesn't just sit there like an object on a shelf waiting for you. It's something that flows dynamically through a network. And so you don't just reach out and grab it, but rather you learn to adapt to it, to follow its shapes and to shape it to your own use. A writer once styled this as being like surfing on the waves, right? Knowledge is being, and learning is being like the waves. And you don't stand there and collect the wave. Nobody collects the wave. You can't. It's too big, it's too fast, and it won't be there in a couple minutes. So what you do is you ride the wave. You surf on the wave. You see the wave, you adapt to it, and then you use the wave to move you forward. On connectivist pedagogy, on the pedagogical model, the learning model that follows from this theory, the educational theory is actually very simple and very straightforward. There's no magic tricks. There's never any magic tricks. To teach is to model and to demonstrate. I sometimes say that you should be the sort of person that you want your students to learn to be. There's a song out there by the Dixie Chicks, which is an American band, that says, our children are watching us. They're going to be like us. The strongest teaching that we do is in our own actions and our own behaviors. And so the idea is that if we want people to learn to, say, study physics, then we show them, we model the practice of being a physicist. If we want people to learn how to farm, then we show them, we practice, we actually do farming. And then the learner, in turn, practices and reflects. It is their task to watch and to try to do what their teacher is doing and then to think about that practice. And both of these involve participation in a community. It's not the teacher here, the learner here, and the teacher delivering, but rather the teacher and the learner both together in a single community, both interacting, both taking part. That's why once I'm done here, I'll be just another person in the crowd. I'll be messing around on my computer or somebody else's computer and trying to learn new things just like you, because that's the way it typically works. And the learning will diffuse, it will spread out through the people who are here. So the role of a teacher is to work openly, to work transparently, to make all the different things that they do obvious and evident to the student. To work is, as I said, to engage in the community, to take part, to practice physics with physicists, to do farming with farmers, whatever. And then to be openly reflective, to not just do it, but to talk about it, to write about it. That's why the work that I've done, and I've done this work for a number of years as a researcher, and I've been open in my practice. I have a website, I put blog posts and other articles on my website, and I want people to see, not that I am perfect, because I'm not, I want people to see how I think, how I practice, the steps that I take in order to accomplish something. They have a better plan. That's not a better plan. Is to attach themselves to an environment where people are working, where people are practicing, where people are communicating, to become a part of that community. Now, it might be a real world thing. They might go work on a farm, or they might go to a courtroom and learn how to follow trials or whatever. They might go to a business. Or it might be a model or a simulation of that environment. A role-playing game, like Second Life, for example, or support systems at work, or a community of practice where people talk about and discuss the subject of the learning. The role of the learner is to observe, and then to try to emulate or to copy successful practice. If you see somebody doing that successful, you watch what they do, then you try it yourself. And you keep trying it, because probably the first time you try it yourself, you fail. It's like playing darts. You watch the expert play darts. You're all familiar with darts? Okay, good. I can learn these. Sometimes there's things we do in Canada that they don't do elsewhere. So anyhow, you watch the expert throw the dart, and then you, the learner, try to throw the dart. The expert throws the dart, it goes right in the middle. You, the learner, throw the dart, it misses the board. That's the way it works. But you watch the expert, you practice. You watch the expert, you practice. And then you need to be reflective. You ask yourself, what did I do? Why did that work? Why did that not work? And so you're emulating, you're doing what they do, but you're trying to think about it yourself and make it your own. So all of this leads to a domain that we call e-learning 2.0. So, as I mentioned before, the core idea of e-learning 2.0 is that knowledge and learning is not static. It's not like books stored in a library. Rather, as I said, the idea is that learning is more like a utility. It's more like the water flowing in the tap. It's more like the waves in the ocean that you catch and you surf. Now, one of the discoveries that we've made is that the way people learn is the way networks learn. The way a single individual learns for themselves is also the way a group of people working in a network will learn. And it has to do with the organization of the knowledge as connections between different ideas. So in a society, knowledge is organized by connecting people together. In a brain, knowledge is organized by connecting neural cells together. And it's funny, Diego and I were looking at the airplanes because we're near the airport here, and thinking about, you know, what it takes to fly an airplane. An airplane is an incredibly complex thing. And the only way to get an airplane to take off successfully and not crash is for a large group of people to be working together. And the way they work together is each person communicates with the other person, and each person does different things. So one person is the pilot, another person is the navigator, another person is the mechanic. And all the connections between these people, that is what creates the knowledge that allows that airplane to fly. And that knowledge is not in any one person, it's not in any one place, it's throughout the whole network as a whole. From a pedagogical point of view, this kind of learning becomes very learner-centered, because we think of the learner as an individual now who is placed or put into the center of the network. And this is not just your students, this is yourself as well. So you think of yourself as a node in the network. You think of yourself, imagine yourself, you're connected here, you're connected here, you're connected here. And all of these connections that you have to other people, that's where your knowledge comes from. And the connections you have create the flow of knowledge that goes through you. It's that flow that you want to tap into that creates the learning. I really have to get better at this. I watched Diego, he just goes, process every time. This kind of learning is immersive learning. It is learning by doing. It's like the learning that you'll be doing today. It's learning not by watching. It's learning by getting your hands on, as they say, getting your hands dirty, and actually trying to do things for yourself. It's connected learning. You will connect with each other. And very importantly, you will also be connected with the world. The things that you do don't necessarily just stay in this room. We have Time World. That's not really pointing up very well. I'm pointing to here as well. Sorry, world. We have like a live broadcast going to the rest of the world. We have web pages that are accessible to the rest of the world. The idea is that we create the conversation in our group, but we also create the conversation with the wider world. And the idea is that the learning may begin here, but it doesn't end here. It continues on in other places and other times. Some of the examples of e-learning 2.0 are some of the game-based learning that people do, especially games where there are multiple participants online. I got my start in e-learning in something called a multi-user domain, or a MUD, which was an online game with many different people connected from all around the world. And we were all in this one environment, and we were trying different things, and we were communicating with each other and cooperating in this single environment. And there are games like that today. I mentioned Second Life, and some of you will have a chance to look at Second Life today. And there's another game called World of Warcraft, which is more of a game than just an environment, and others like that. It's workflow or informal learning. The idea here, again, is you are in your workplace, you are doing your work, whether it's teaching or office work or being a physicist or whatever. And as you do your work, you're connected to your friends, your neighbors, to people around the world. And you're connected to a support system, and they call it an electronic performance support system, EPSS, that helps you and gives you the resources that you need to do your work whenever you do your work. It's mobile learning. It's learning that isn't just attached to a computer on a desktop, but it's learning that's available through your mobile phone or through a personal digital assistant or any of these other devices. People are getting these devices in their cars now, so their cars begin to teach them. You may have seen this with global positioning systems and that, where you're driving around and you have your GPS and your dashboard. Your car is telling you where to go, which is kind of backwards, but still. So, the first iteration where this begins to happen, again, is in user-produced media. Because all of these resources that teach you in different places need to come from somewhere. And some people have the theory that they will all be produced by publishers and commercial providers and things like that. But I don't think so. And I don't think so because we need too many things. There are too many types of resources and things change too rapidly. Think about it. If you're on the job and you need to know something, how to make a projector work or how to unstick the photocopier or whatever, you need to know something, what do you do? Do you call a publisher and say, would you please print a book for me? No. Do you sign up for a class? You know, I'm going to take a class in photocopying 1.1, and when I'm done that class, I'll be able to know. You ask your friend. You turn, you say, how do I unstick the photocopier? And your friend produces some educational content. You don't think of it that way, right? But that's what they're doing. They say, well, first you hit this lever, then you do this lever, then you put your hand in and reach out. So they're producing educational resources. And that's what happens online. That's where this web, this network of learning comes from, is all of the learners produce learning resources. And these learning resources are produced every day on an as-needed basis. We're producing learning resources here. These resources will be useful now. In 10 years, not so useful. But we'll have different resources. And that's where the flow comes from. Everybody's producing these resources. Again, think of the conversation that you have in the workplace. You ask your friend, how do I unstick the photocopier? Do you not try to capture that knowledge and put it on a shelf just in case? Well, no. You use the knowledge, then you're done. And in the practice of using that knowledge, you remember a little bit. And then in the passing on of that knowledge, you remember a little bit more. But it becomes a flow, not something that's static. So we have now being developed on the internet something called Web 2.0. And Web 2.0 is the intersection, the place where things come together between education, work, and home. It's a way of accessing easy-to-use services to manage this creation of learning, this creation of learning content. What this produces is personal learning. And the idea here is that these are the ways that you use these tools in order to produce learning for yourself. The first and most important principle, as I've mentioned, is interaction. It's being part of this network. It means providing people with answers if they ask you questions. It means asking them questions, being part of this information flow. The other thing is usability. And what I mean by that is accessing or using things that are simple and easy for you to use. Using things that work for you. The tool that somebody else uses might not be the tool that you should use. Everybody should use whatever works best for them. I should not use this again. And then relevance. The idea here is the information being what you want, where you want, and how you want it. The idea here is learning that helps you right now. Traditionally, we've always thought of learning as something that we learn just in case. But more and more, by being part of a learning network, we're learning things that we need now. Sometimes they say just in time learning. I'm not really crazy about that expression, but in interaction, the idea here is that you are in charge of your own interactions. That's what I mean when I say pull is better than push. What I mean is you choose the sources of information that you want. You ask who you trust. You don't just, you know, sometimes people think, well, somebody who has the answers, they'll come and they'll tell you. This doesn't quite work like that. You have to pick the friend that you trust. You have to pick the provider that you trust or the website that you trust. When you provide content and information, you need to speak in your own genuine, authentic voice. The idea here is that you're not providing just information, but you're providing a perspective, a point of view. It's information the way you see it from your perspective, and that's what makes it valuable, because it's information, it's learning that only you can provide. And it's that perspective that makes your information useful to them. Getting close, Diego? No? Usually when the organizer walks up there, it's usually with the big hook.
No. Not this time.
And the other thing about interaction, and I really want to stress this, and this is nice that the phone rings as I say this, interaction should be a habit, it should be a priority, it should be the first thing you do. People say to me sometimes, I don't have time for email, I don't have time to read websites. And I say, well, how are you trying to learn then? How are you learning? You're spending more time trying to learn in other ways, you're simply not knowing. By being interactive, by being connected with other people, that saves you time and that creates knowledge. So that should be your first priority. And I say make it a habit. And I speak out of my own practice here. My own practice has been every day to put something online in my newsletter. Well, every weekday. I take weekends off because I need my weekends. But every weekday I put something online. And I make that a habit. It's just something I do. Every morning I read my email. Every evening I do my newsletter. And that creates an interaction. It's by making it a habit that it becomes easy, that it becomes part of your life. It's like exercise. Some of you may go out and jog or use the bicycles or whatever. And when you first started, it was hard to find the time. But after you've around the time, then it just became a part of your life. A full 10 minutes of this presentation is needed. The principles of usability. People ask me sometimes, how do you survive in a world that's constant change? And I say, by doing the same things, by keeping my activities consistent, by keeping them simple. Again, think of a surfer on a surfboard, or a skateboarder on a skateboard, or even a person riding a bicycle. They're managing a very complex process, but they do it the same way, and they use the same simple principles. And it's these simple principles that allow them to interact in a complex environment. Sometimes I push too soft. Sometimes I push too hard. And then finally, relevance. And again, I can't repeat it enough times, thinking of information as a flow, not being worried about capturing the information, just putting yourself in the flow. Let that flow happen. Right? Don't try to memorize, don't try to put it on the shelf, but just let the flow come through and try to adapt to that flow, try to live with that flow. It's very Zen Buddhist, I guess. I just want to offer a few words on the types of networks that create good learning, because I want to emphasize being in a network does not automatically create good learning. And so there are some things that we want to foster in our connections with other people. The first of these things, this is the first semantic principle, is diversity. And it is better to be connected with many different people, different perspectives, different points of view, because each one is unique. Each one gives a different way of looking at a topic. If you get the same message from all the different people, you don't learn as much, right? So you want your network to be diverse, not just your friends, but people in other communities, people around the world. The second principle is autonomy. Now, what I mean by that is where people make their own decisions, where individual learners, and this means not only you, but it certainly does mean you, but also your own learners, make their own decisions. The idea is that everybody defines for themselves what they want to do in their lives, what they think is good, what they think is valuable, and they make those decisions, and it's the totality of those individual decisions that make up the whole. The third principle is openness. And what that is the idea that the network is open to all. The idea that anybody can contribute to the network, anybody can draw from the network. There are not privileged contributors to the network. If you have a privileged contributor, then you're magnifying a certain point of view artificially. And that creates the possibility that there might be an error created in the network. Even here, I always worry when I come and I give a talk, because my perspective here right now is being magnified, isn't it? And the question is, well, what if I'm wrong? What if I'm making a mistake, and all of you are listening to me, and you're listening to false information, you're going to go off and do bad things, or incorrect things. So the idea here is that even even if you have a speaker or something like that, you need to balance that perspective with other perspectives, other points of view. For every person that comes here and tells you, this is the way the world is, you need somebody else to say, no, it isn't. And so if there are people in this room who are thinking that I'm standing up here and I'm just giving you a load of junk, then those people should be speaking up, they should be making their thinkings and their voices heard, so that the errors that I make, and I will make errors, can be corrected by the combined knowledge of everyone. So that's more interactivity happening. I encourage interactivity. It just, you have to broadcast your phone call to everyone. I'm just kidding. And then the final element is connectivity. And what I mean by that is, it's not just one message that goes through the network, it's everybody's message. Everybody speaks, everybody receives. And that's where learning is produced, and that's where knowledge is produced. And you will find this. You probably, if those of you who are online now, on the internet now, you will have already seen this, that knowledge is produced through the connectivity with other people, through these conversations. Finally, the personal learning environment. The personal learning environment is not a piece of software. And I've already described a lot of the personal learning environment. It's an idea, it's a concept, it's a way of looking at the world. And again, the personal learning environment is thinking of yourself as something that learns. And then thinking of the different kinds of connections that you make with other people, the different kinds of information that flow through that, and then aligning or organizing your own access to information, your own learning, in accordance with this view that you have of yourself. Now that sounds complicated, but it's really very simple. Imagine yourself, I think most of you are teachers, right? So imagine yourself, you're in your classroom, and you are going to teach a lesson. What you do is you think about what you are going to do. And at that moment, you are creating your personal learning environment. And so you ask yourself, where am I going to get the content to teach my class? Well, there's a textbook here. There's a workbook here. There's a video maybe here. There's things that you know about that topic because you practiced. So here's the place where you practice. How do you get information about your students? You need information about your students. Well, there will be the student records in the principal's office, right? Or the school records. There will be the things that the other teachers tell you. The teacher says, you know, watch out for one. He never pays attention. Yeah, that's part of your personal learning environment. There may be information that has been sent by their parents. If your student has to take a break in the middle of the day for medication or something, I don't know. There will be receipts or information. So if you think about all the different sources of the information, even think about your classroom. The classroom is the place where you do your work. How do you organize your classroom? Do you put wall charts on the wall, maps, or things like that? I still remember in elementary school, the letter AA, BB, CC, right? The information in front of me organized. Do you leave the windows open, or do you close the windows? Or close the curtain? All of that forms part of the environment. So you're thinking of yourself in the center as connected to all these different forms of information. And it works the same way online, except you are much more of a creator of this environment. You don't depend on the publishers. You don't depend on the principal's office. You initiate these connections. You shape your own environment. And that's what all of these tools are intended to do. People talk about content. Content, even things like that, that's known as a LOL cat. L-O-L, cat. It stands for laugh out loud cat. And it's a really stupid thing, but I love it. It's a picture, usually of cats. I love cats. And then there's some sort of slogan put on there. This is Warriors Come Out and Play. It's from a movie. I don't know if you remember. It's a great movie. It's from the 1970s. It's called The Warriors. And it's about a gang in New York. They have to go through New York and fight off all kinds of other gangs. And right in the middle of the movie, there's somebody who goes, Warriors Come Out and Play. I can't do it very well, but you know. But the thing is, this picture, those words, creates a single piece of content. This single piece of content is embedded in a culture. It becomes a cultural reference. And that is like a word in the vocabulary of the information. So when you're creating videos, when you're creating pictures, think of them as like words that you are going to send to other people in your network. And when you get things like that, it's not just a funny picture, but it is. But it's information. It tells you about this person's culture, about this person's background, about what they think is funny. Think of content not just as stuff that's brought in together, but content as creation. And I sometimes talk about the four stages of working in the network. The first stage is to aggregate, to bring the information to you. And again, think of yourself as a teacher in a classroom, right? You're going to bring the information in. Then you remix it. You organize the information according to your own priorities. And then you repurpose it. You prepare it for your particular class. You might have to change the language. You might have to change the presentation. You repurpose it to the task that you're doing. And then you feed it forward. And the thing is, you do this task, and then your students do this task too. Because the way you learn, the way you teach, is the way your students learn, the way your students teach. So the students aggregate the information from you, from other people. They remix it. They repurpose it. They feed it forward. So you and your students are basically doing the same thing. This is a very famous diagram. This is the concept of the PLE, of the personal learning environment, expressed as software. In the center, where it says future VLE, that's VLE stands for virtual learning environment. It's a term that they use in Britain. This was created by Scott Wilson, who works in Britain. That's you. That's where you are. And you are at the center of this personal learning environment. And those are all the connections, connecting to different types of applications. And so you see in the upper left, live journal. You connect to a blogging application. You create blog posts. You read blog posts. 43 things in the upper right, which is a to-do list. Flickr in the lower right, which is a place where you store photographs. And you might also have hosting of your own content. You might also have connections to a college, to a university. The main point here is you are in the center. You have all of these choices. You make these choices about which connections to make, and then that set of choices becomes your personal learning environment. This is an example of a personal learning environment that was created by Cetus in Britain. I think it's kind of, well, it's much like Windows. But the idea is that this sort of technology is being developed. People are creating applications now to help you manage your different sources of information. But whether or not you have an application, the concept is the same. It's organizing your different connections to different types of information. Here's this aggregating and feeding forward. You see the RSS, RSS, RSS? That's me aggregating things. And then I join them, I remix them, I filter them, I repurpose them, and then I feed them forward. And there are applications, it's not on our list yet, it's called Superglue. I knew there was something that we forgot. But there are applications out there, one of them is Superglue, with glue spelled like that, it's ridiculous, that actually bring together different sources of information. And me, because I have to do it, I created something called MyGlue, which does the same thing. And we'll be looking, though, at sites like PageFlakes and other things that bring different sources of information together. Oops. Joel's point was that the audience doesn't work that way. Here's another, a different take on a personal learning environment. On the left-hand side is a panel where I have content that I bring in from multiple different sources. And then on the right-hand side is the place where I work with that content, and I create new content with it. And then where it says content sources, if I scroll down there, that's where I feed forward. So I send my content to Blogger or to LiveJournal or to some other place on the web. There's yet another way of looking at it. It's sort of funny. It's sort of like there's a background, like musical soundtrack. Quite unique. Next time I'll bring in my own speakers. So again, this is just another way where I'm looking at content as it comes in, and then you see where it says blog this. If I hit this button, I'm taken to a place where I can write about the content and feed it forward. And what I'm doing here is I'm trying to show you that there are many different looks to this concept, many different appearances of this concept. The idea is that as you create content, as you participate in the network, you're creating relations or connections between entities, between people and resources, between resources and events, between events and other resources and organizations, and it creates this whole rich web of connection. And it's the information flowing through this rich web that creates your learning and creates your content. The PLE, the personal learning environment, goes back to those principles of how we learn ourselves, the role of the teacher and the role of the learner. Remember I talked earlier in this talk about modeling and demonstrating, and I talked earlier about practicing and reflecting. These are the roles of the teacher and the learner. In the middle there is me. And so the personal learning environment is intended to be, or best, better yet, best thought of as the place where I, in the center, do the task of modeling, do the task of reflecting, do the task of practicing or reflecting. There we go. So think about modeling. Think about how you would model your behavior. You know how you model your behavior in a class. And, you know, even the words that you speak, the way you talk will be imitated by your students. If you start, you can do this as an experiment. Just start using an unusual word, just in conversation. And then listen to your students begin to use that word over time. In the online world, we model our demonstration using, we create conceptual frameworks in places like wikis, or we create concept maps, or we create diagrams. There's another one we did, an application called Gliffy. And this is a place online where you can create your own diagrams that you can then save or send as email or even print out. Very handy, useful applications. You can use tools like Wikipedia. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Wikipedia, but Wikipedia, again, is not just something that you read, it's something that you write. And so you can use Wikipedia as a place where you can create content for your students. Now, the content will be shaped by the wider community, but it's a place where you can contribute. And it's also a place where your students can contribute. Your students, too, should be modeling. They model the learning that they've done. Think about how you demonstrate. And sometimes you demonstrate, suppose you're teaching a class in programming, you demonstrate coding by actually writing some code, or mathematics by working some examples. Well, you can do this online as well. And you can show your thought process, show what you were thinking as you worked through this problem, what you were thinking as you created this piece of code. And you put this online, I use my blog to do that. I write articles in my blog. Today I tried to get Moodle working. And I did this, and I did this, and I did this, and then it stopped working. And I couldn't figure out why. So I tried this, that didn't work. I tried this, and that didn't work. The idea here is documenting your thought process. Demonstrate what you do. Demonstrate how you do it. And these tools help you do that. Oops, by the way. See, I'm modeling bad practice with this. They say, want to use your computer? No, I'll use this. It'll be easier. Practicing. Think about how you could use or where you go to practice things and the way you can practice online. There are games that you can log on and you play the game, and the game is a way of practicing something. In the world of language learning, there's a lot of these things. You log on to a game and it shows you a word. You have to translate it. Think about other kinds of games that you can use to practice remembering concepts. It's like Jeopardy. It's a very simple sort of game. And somebody asks a question, other people answer it. Just this practice back and forth can be done online. Simulations, and again, things like Second Life are great simulations because they let you get right in there. They just let you get right into the concept. There's a beautiful simulation in Second Life that I just love. That is, it uses Google Maps, and it's a map of Southern California. And then what they've done is they've connected to the flight information database. So they connect to the flight information, they bring that information, and then over this map of Southern California, they put little airplanes. Now, this is Second Life, so it's a three-dimensional environment. It's like this room, right? So here you are in this virtual environment, standing on a map of Southern California, watching the planes fly around. Well, what a great way to learn how to be an air traffic controller, because you can see the little planes. And what I want to see one day, because that's they use actual flight information, I'd like to see them use that as practice, so you control the little planes as they fly over Southern California. That would be fun. I think it would. And I'd like to be an air traffic controller. Another one of my careers. And then finally, reflection. The place where you think about what you've learned, think about how you've learned what you've learned. I use blogs and things like that where I create, just think about what I've done, think about did it work okay. I actually, you can see me, I'm recording my own talk, and I listen to my talk later on, not because I'm an egotist, although I am, but because I like to learn, and I watch myself and I reflect, was it a good talk? Did I go too long? Was I clear? I even look at my hand gestures. Did my hand gestures make sense? You can't learn that simply by doing that. You have to do it and practice it and then look at what you did after and think about it. So the video camera is a very powerful tool. Of course, you don't have to have a big expensive one. You can have the little cheap one that's pointing right here. And even these little cheap video cameras, they show you what you did. So you learn to play darts better, you learn to give better talks, you learn to play other sports better, whatever. It's the reflection. And then finally, running through this is the whole idea of the semantic principle. The choices that you make, the diversity that you create, the identity that you establish for yourself. You create yourself, you create your own knowledge, you create your own being through practicing, through demonstrating, through modeling, and through reflection. And of course I have to get it wrong one last time. This here is my website, dallas.ca. And you can see me being a researcher on that site, attempting to model the practice. And these slides will be available on that site. So I'll put them up. Since we do have wireless here, I'll try to put them up sometime today. And I will also make audio and video of this talk available. So I will go over it to learn myself, but you can go over it. And so if any part of it went too fast, you're able to review it. And it's licensed under Creative Commons. And this is an important thing, is to take the content, the ideas, make them your own. Mix them with other things that you know, and feel free to lead them forward, because the whole idea here is this is just one activity in the network. So you take this content, you do whatever you want with it, it becomes yours. So thank you very much, and this is going to be, I think, a very interesting day, and I appreciate you all being here so early in the morning to be here to start up. Thank you.
No vamos a tener una sesión de preguntas porque todo el día va a estar lleno de preguntas, así que mejor seguimos avanzando. Bueno, lo que sí ahora es que empecemos a trabajar. Ya tenemos un contexto de todo el asunto de las personas de aprendizaje y de qué se trata. A lo que queremos invitarlos ahora es que empecemos a hacer el ejercicio de caracterizar nuestro propio ambiente personal de aprendizaje. No, desde el punto de vista conceptual, si ustedes veían, yo mencionaba, ilustraba un diagrama de fondo de lo que podría ser cómo podría verse un ambiente personal de aprendizaje.